Thanks, Ray.
It's the Ray Dassey Show on RTE Radio 1. Enjoy the show.
Thanks, Jeremy. Good afternoon on this Thursday afternoon. 51551 for your texts. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. Unscheduled disassembly. Now, there's a euphemism if ever I heard one. An amazing piece of kit, but it blew up. It consists of 230-foot tall Starship, super heavy first stage, powered by 33 methane-burning Raptor engines and a bullet-shaped 160-foot tall Starship second stage that is equipped with 6 Raptor of its own. That's engines again. As well as steerable fins at the nose and tail to control the ship during atmospheric re-entry from space. The two stages together can lift 100 tonnes to low Earth orbit, and it's going to change space travel. Well, when it works, it will, because both stages are designed to be fully reusable, and they'll be able to bring, you know, houses up into space. That's the plan. But it's not going according to plan now. Unmanned, just that's the important thing. It's unmanned, so no casualties there, just pride, I suppose, and bank balances. Now, today on the show, it's a full show today. Brian O'Driscoll is going to be talking to us after 4 o'clock about life and rugby and the women's rugby team's game against England this weekend in Musgrave Park. They want to get a full Musgrave Park, all 8,008 seats, one full of Irish fans. And Brian will be talking to us about that and other things after 4 o'clock. We're talking to Elizabeth Day. She's the author of How to Fail, which is a book and a podcast. And her new book is called Friendaholic, Confessions of a Friendship Addict. I've been reading it over the last couple of days. It's a brilliant book, and it asks loads of questions about friendship. What is it? Do we have enough? Do we have too many? In her case, during the lockdown, she decided that she had too many. And how many is enough? Loads of questions. Anyway, I'm sure you'd want to be involved in that conversation about friendship. And that's Elizabeth Day. Patrick Bergen, star of the best exotic Marigold Hotel, coming to Bord Gáis Energy Theatre, will be in. He's always interesting company, is Patrick Bergen. And I'm looking forward to that. And of course, we have our whodunit quiz. And sitting in front of me, Josh Ritter. Good afternoon, Josh.
How's it going? How's it going?
The nicest man in showbiz. That's that.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Good to see you again. I'm just figuring, we know each other for 23 years now, Josh.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Wow.
Can you remember your first gig in Ireland?
Yes, I can. I remember coming up the street and going to a Bewley's and my first cup of tea. And then I showed up at Road Records down on Faye Street and they just let me in, even though they didn't know who I was. It was early in the morning and let me lie down for a few minutes. I'll never forget. And then Whelan's that night.
Yeah. Okay. And you've been coming ever since.
Ever since. Yeah. I can't get enough.
You have a strong fan base in Ireland.
They're very strong.
Yes.
Yeah. They've been working out.
Listen, big news in the last 24 hours. Tell us. Go on.
I just heard that that Bob Dylan covered one of my songs in Japan, which I'm very, very proud
of.
Yeah.
That is big news, isn't
it? It's huge. I've covered enough of his, you know, so.
And he's the songwriter, I suppose, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. Yeah, it's great.
And he must get sent so many songs.
Boy, man. I can't even imagine.
So let's have a listen to it. It's Only a River.
Yeah, it's me and Bob Weir.
And this isn't you. This is Bob singing.
This is Bob singing. So just, Bob Weir.
And this is the song that Bob Dylan sang last night in Japan. Oh, Shenandoah, a long sea. The songs you've written over the years, why do you think he chose that one?
I don't know, but that's I remember writing that back in a stairwell of a dorm in college, and you know, it's so funny how, oh, like, you know, we've known each other so long, and like me and you, and they just thinking about how time like expands and contracts, and it doesn't seem like that long.
No, 23 years. And so that song is that old. How long?
That song's about 25 years old.
What?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, amazing.
How did you find out that Bob Dylan covered it?
My friend Josh Kaufman, who's in my band, an amazing guitar player, and a big Dylan fanatic, just sent me a note.
Wow, that's great news. Sad news, you lost your mum in 2021, and she sounded like an amazing woman, and you were very close to her.
Yeah.
And there's a lovely quote that you tweeted around the time, from that she said that there is an artistry to all things that are done well.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. She was, both my parents were scientists and very, very scientific minded. But, you know, I found through just watching them for so long that the difference, there's no difference between art and science. It's still about being excited for what will happen next, you know, and there's a joy to that, and it kind of illuminates the rest of.
And both of them being scientists, and you deciding to go down the rock and roll route.
Yeah.
How was that received?
You know, they were thrilled. They were. I remember calling them and telling them, you know, I don't think I'm going to be able to pass this chemistry test. And the truth was that I hadn't been going, you know, but they said, well, that's totally fine. Just, you know, we didn't think you were going to be a scientist. We did. There was no way, you know.
Because parents know, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, they were great about it. They've always been so good about it.
That there is an artistry to all things that are done well. I just love that. I'm going to keep that with me. Yeah. Right, you have a new album coming out, which is called Spectral Lines, and dedicated to your mum.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she, her spirit is there throughout.
Definitely. You know, I started writing, you know, the pandemic and my mom's death and sickness at that time, you know, were so of a piece, you know, and so it's taken a while to kind of, you know, disentangle the strands of those two traumatic, weird experiences. But really the thing that came out of my mom's death and being there with her when she died was just such a profound and beautiful experience. And there was, you know, it's one of those things that I've heard somebody say, you know, there are ineffable experiences, but we try hard to F them, you know? and that was what this record was about, trying to put into words the feelings.
Right. Okay. So Strong Swimmer from Spectral Lines. That's the first one you're going to sing for us today. Josh,
sure.
When you're ready.
All right. On the night that you were born, your mama, who had many friends, took you down across the reach to meet the tide come in. There were no lilies from my footsteps, there were no temple curtains torn, still I felt you move inside me, a strong swimmer to be born. La da 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 da. All the wind was in my hair, and your cheeks reflect the salt. Your eyes were two boats for the moon. I said, a strong swimmer you'll be called. La da 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 da. Now I cannot believe to see the leagues that you have swum. Cannot believe you once were me and you and I were one. Time only travels one way, I'm afraid, still I'm a fool. Cause in my mind I try to wind the twine back on the spool. Now I'm standing on the cliffs in the cold sea far below, and the birds that float the midway air like driven flakes of snow. I cannot go where you are going, I can no longer fight those waves, still I'll watch you till you're out of sight, a strong swimmer all the way. La da 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 da.
on the night you were born. Your mama, who had many friends, took you down across the reach to meet the tide coming.
Wow.
Thank you.
That was that was pitch perfect in every way.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it was just so lovely, so lovely. That was live. I have to remind people that that was live. That was live. Josh Ritter there. Just wondering, can you say hi to Josh? We can't wait to see him later for a big squeeze. Myself, Caroline, Dad Lar and Mum Breda have been longtime fans for the last 22 years. We last saw him 4 years ago in the National Concert Hall in Dublin with my little boy, Connor.
Oh, that's Caroline.
Yeah, that's Caroline, Connor and all the Savages.
Yes, yeah, all of them.
Savage fans, Savage fans. So was that with reference to one of your daughters there?
I always thought, like, I'm not going to be the guy who writes about his kids, you know, because they get enough to be embarrassed about, you know, like, but I have felt things over time growing up and being a parent, you know, where you sort of watch them, you know, watch them take the shuttle into, you know, into space or someplace unknown and want to just, you know, want to go with them, but no, you can't.
Yeah. Because they're individuals.
Yeah.
They are themselves. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, I never heard of Josh Ritter before, but I've just fallen under his spell. It reminds me so much of the magnificent John Prine. What a comparison.
That's,
there.
Thank you.
You'll take that. Josh is going to stay with us some more of Josh Ritter later on. And the new album is Spectral Lines, and it's released at the end of next week. And Josh is playing Liberty Hall Theatre in Dublin tonight. It's sold out. That's tough. But you can go to see if we'll be back, joshritter.com. For the moment, Josh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Ray.
Now, the Whodunit quiz. Let's get going on that one. Here we go. Yeah, so we're looking for two of you to come on air after 4 o'clock and answer three whodunit questions on music, sport, TV, books, politics, films, comedians, anything that involves human endeavour. And like all whodunits, there will be clues. If you answer without a clue, you get two. If you go with a clue, it's easier, so you get 1 point for a correct answer. And the prize this week, it's a two-night stay for two people in the Killarney Towers Hotel and Leisure Centre. And you get dinner on one of the evenings in the Innisfallen restaurant, and you get complimentary drinks and live music in O'Donoghue's public house. So whether you want to explore everything that the Wild Atlantic Way has to offer, or just explore what Killarney has to offer, Killarney Towers Hotel is the ideal base. KillarneyTowers.com. KillarneyTowers.com. Here's your qualifying question on this Thursday afternoon. Ireland play England in the women's rugby this weekend. Is it the Six Nations or the Four Nations? Ireland play England in the women's rugby this weekend in the Six Nations or the Four Nations? 0818 715 925. 0818 715 925. And we'll speak to Elizabeth Day after this.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Helen has been on. What a class act. Fantastic. Hard to believe that was live. Great stuff, says Helen. Josh will be back before 4 o'clock. Now, we love a good... let's start again. We love a good statistic on this show. And one of the many stats that we learned from Elizabeth Day's latest book is that it takes 200 hours in the space of a few months to make a stranger into a good friend. And that's what Elizabeth has done again and again and again with people in her life, because as the title tells us, she's a friendaholic. And Elizabeth Day is on the line from her home in South London. How are you doing, Elizabeth?
I'm doing great, Ray. Thanks so much for having me.
Good to talk to you. Is it nice to do these interviews from, you know, the comfort of your home?
It's lovely, although I'm not actually in my home. I would be, but I'm about to record a podcast, so I'm actually in central London at the moment.
Oh, are you right?
It's lovely. It's lovely. I mean, although I do love coming to Ireland, I love any excuse to get over there. So that's a bit of a shame. But otherwise, it's very nice. I've got my cup of tea right here.
Great, great. OK, so we can talk as friends. So there is a strong Irish connection in that you lived in Derry for a number of years during your childhood.
I did. That's right. So as you can hear from my accent, I was born in England, and my dad, he's now retired, but he was a surgeon. And my grandmother had come from Belfast, and happened to get a job in Derry in 1982. And so we moved over to Derry as a family, and I grew up there for most of my life. And actually, it's interesting you raise it, because it has a lot to do with my historic attitude to friendship and that idea of being friendaholic, because I went to a secondary school in Belfast, and primary school had been absolutely fine and everyone had been really friendly and welcoming to me. But secondary school in the late 80s, early 90s in Belfast was quite tricky to navigate if you did have an English accent, as I did. And so I felt like an outsider, and I got a bit bullied, and I felt very alone. And when I ended up changing schools halfway through my third year, I went to that new school absolutely determined to make as many friends as possible, because I felt that that would make me feel safe. And it would also make me feel accepted. And I think where I went wrong is that I adopted that mindset, and I stuck at it through my 20s and 30s. And what I hadn't realized was that I hadn't differentiated between the difference with belonging, which is when you're accepted as you really are, and fitting in, which is when you change yourself to meet someone else's needs or demands. And I was doing the latter, and I became codependent on that kind of quote-unquote friendship.
Right. So you ended up in lockdown, like a lot of us, having a look at your life, and you're saying, God, I might have too many friends. Is there something wrong
exactly
with me?
Yes. I mean, I know that sounds ridiculous, and maybe you'll be getting out your tiny violins as you're listening to this. but it wasn't so much that I had too many friends. It was that I'd misunderstood the nature of friendship.
Right.
So I realized my diary emptied out overnight, as it did for everyone. And I realized that I've been spending a lot of time racing around town, trying to meet people for dinner who I'd only just met, you know, who I'd met randomly at a work event or a yoga class. And simply because they had been friendly, I mistook that for needing to pursue an active friendship. And I realized that actually my closest friends, those people who really nurtured my soul, they were not the ones that I was spending most of my time with, because they were very conscious that I was busy and they didn't necessarily place demands on my diary. And I thought, well, that can't be right, can it? And I want to rebalance this. And why has it got this way? And that was the starting point for this book about friendship, which is also an attempt to give a language to a really profound and important kind of love, platonic love, in the way that we've done as a society for romantic love for many, many centuries.
You say, and I quote, underexplored and an integral to the fabric of our being, we need a new vocabulary for friendship. So you, I suppose, what is, let's define the terms then. So what do you believe to be a friend or friendship?
This is so funny because I've never been asked that before, right? And you're totally right to ask it, because it's one of the first things I do in the book is I define it. So the kind of straightforward definition is that it's a reciprocal relationship that doesn't involve like a sexual relationship.
Right. So platonic.
It's platonic. You're not related to that person.
Okay.
You voluntarily choose to hang out with them.
Right.
My definition of friendship and what friendship means to me personally is something that I discovered through the course of writing this. And for me, the most important metric of friendship is generosity of spirit. So that idea that someone is always thinking the best that they can of you, and that it doesn't necessarily mean you have to have a weekly phone call and you have to ensure that you've got that dinner booked every single month to keep it chugging over. They will always think the best of me. And when I do meet up with them, I hope I do the same for them. And we can hit relational depth really, really quickly. That for me is my metric. And for other listeners, it might be a different metric. It might be, oh, actually, I need a monthly mini break, or I need a shared interest, or I need total honesty for my friendship. And I actually think one of the things I really am passionate about advocating for is that everyone should sit down and have a little think about what they most value in friendship and what they're seeking out.
What you want, what you expect, and what you can deliver.
Exactly that. It's almost like we've got very used to checking in with our physical health and our mental health. And I would add friendship health to that as well. That it's, you know, we should check in regularly that our friendships are in a good state of health.
It's like you're evangelistic about this. And because you, did you look back in your life and think you've been doing it wrongly a bit? Is that it? Is that why you're so strong on it?
Yeah, I think I'm extremely blessed in that I believe that I have a gift for connection.
Right.
And that partly comes from growing up in the north of Ireland and being someone who listened more than she spoke, and having a degree of empathy for an outsider. And I think that served me well in my other job as a journalist and a broadcaster. But I think what I was doing wrong was that I had a fundamental lack of self-esteem. And instead of trying to fix that myself and almost befriending myself, I looked to others to fix it for me. And my internal reasoning was, well, if I've got lots of friends, I must be okay, because these people like me. And that can be quite damaging, because you can end up never taking the trouble to know yourself, and you can end up getting into relationships, both platonic and romantic, where actually the other person doesn't really see who you are. And sometimes there's a real tension there, and those relationships or friendships end and you're not quite sure why. So really, for me, it was about doing the work on myself first, and then understanding that I wasn't a failure simply because I was not able to keep every single friendship in my life going forever and ever, which is an unrealistic expectation, right? Because we don't have it of romantic relationships. We have this notion that, you know, we'll date a number of people and then we might settle down, and even then we might get divorced. And the sense of failure and shame isn't the same when a romantic relationship ends as it is with a friendship. And so that's another point that I have come to realize, is that a friendship doesn't have to be a failure simply because it ends. It could just belong to a different phase of your life.
Now, you talk to five of your best friends in the book.
Yes.
Emma, Charmaine, Joan, Clemmie, and Satnam.
That's right.
And you ask them about your relationship with them and what you mean to them and what they mean to you, and you discuss that. And that's a good way of teasing out you know, the notion of friendship. And you also have these friendship tapes, which I like, where you speak to a diverse bunch of people about what friendship means to them. And I think everyone will gravitate towards Wilkie, who is the youngest, the youngest in the book. And he's your godson, isn't he?
He's my honorary godson.
Honorary godson,
Wilkie,
right.
Yeah, he wrote me a letter asking if I could be his special adult friend, is how he put
right,
it,
okay.
A few years ago. But he's the son of a very, very good friend of mine, yes.
Right. And he says, my definition of a friend is someone that I look forward to seeing and someone that invites me over to their house and I invite them over to my house. Having a friend is different from being friendly, because you can be friendly to someone you don't like, but you can't be friends with someone you don't like. Say there, like out of the mouths of babes, huh? So he cuts through all that adult BS, doesn't he? Wilkie does.
Oh, my, totally. He's an amazing person, Wilkie. And you're right. He said some things that turned out to be as profound as, you know, Cicero, who I also quote.
Right, there you go.
Yeah, he was just amazing.
Okay, so male friends, you list one of them, and you spoke to Satnam. My mother believes that there's no such thing as a platonic friendship between a man and a woman. And I've argued this point with her an awful lot. She says that they either have had sex, or one of them wants to have sex, or both of them want to have sex, but there's always sex in somewhere in the picture.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I think that that has massively changed through the generations.
Right.
Partly because men have got more used to seeing women at work, partly because of birth control, and partly because there's just much more connectedness between all genders now. And so I actually think now, I think it's changed. I think maybe in the 1950s or 60s, the 1950s, it was probably harder for men and women to be platonic friends, because there wasn't that same acceptance of the idea, because the genders existed in very separate spheres and roles. Whereas now, I think we're much more open to it. And my experience is absolutely that you can have friends of any gender. And that particular example with Satnam that you mentioned, Satnam and I were set up on a romantic date and quite quickly identified that there was no romantic chemistry between us, but that we would be much better as friends. And he has become one of my dearest friends. And I really value him because he gives me such a different perspective on issues. Mm. And it's never been an issue for us. But I think Satnam's contention is that you need to have got the sex part out of the way.
Right.
In order to be friends.
He certainly should meet my mother. He should meet my mother.
Yes. Imagine.
but men and friendship and women and friendship, we're wired differently, despite what anybody might tell you. We are wired differently. And I think it's more difficult for men to form friendships.
Yeah. Yes, it's interesting because we live in an age where we have to be so careful about making massive generalizations on gender. And yet you're right that so much of the research around friendship and particularly male friendship shows that straight men tend to hemorrhage friends around their 30s and 40s. And it's because quite a few of them might be settling down and having kids and concentrating on work and supporting their families and so on and so forth. Now, I think that's changing in modern times, but it is a real issue. And I think, again, to generalize, a lot of straight men find it difficult to have those small everyday communications and connections that women are arguably more practiced at. And so one of the things that I discovered in writing the book is that this men's shed movement, which arose in Australia, it was founded by a man called Ray Winder. And it was the idea of creating a shed in a back garden where lonely men could come and do a shared activity.
Yeah, we have them in Ireland. They're all over Ireland.
Right.
Yes.
And
we're planning to do an outside broadcast from the first women's shed in Ireland.
Brilliant. That's so, because I think there's something really important about the idea of shared interest, because it can feel so overwhelming as an adult to make a new friend if we're not practiced at it. Mm. And if we're not being thrown into situations where there are other people, like-minded people, and the shared interest like just makes it, it relieves the pressure. It means you can gather and do something together and then forge a connection that way.
Okay. Yeah, just back to the integral or to the fabric of our being. So that would suggest if we don't have friendships in our life that we're lacking something in a big way. And I would imagine a lot of people don't have friends.
Yes, it is something that I look at in the book, which is that loneliness, feeling socially isolated, is as bad for your physical health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. It genuinely shortens your life expectancy. What I hadn't realized is that by the same token, having too many friends can lead to higher instances of depression. So it's sort of about finding the sweet spot. Mm. But if you are listening to this and you're feeling lonely, and perhaps you're someone who lives with social anxiety, you might be neurodivergent in some way, and therefore the idea of making a friend, it doesn't necessarily seem easy or come that naturally. And my advice to you would be to start small and to try and challenge yourself every day to have some kind of small but meaningful interaction with a stranger. Whether it's a person walking their dog in the park who you just say hello to, whether it's asking the person who makes your coffee their name, just to start with those really small moments. And I truly believe that when you're open to it in that way, friendship does come to you.
We live in a world where we're you know, this is the quote, isn't it, that we've more opportunities to be connected, but more of us are less connected than ever before. how do you feel about, you know, connection through social media, WhatsApp groups, that sort of thing?
Yeah, this is an interesting one, because I knew if I were writing about friendship, I'd have to write about social media. And when I started writing that chapter, I think I had a sense that I would discover that social media was bad in some way for friendships, because you're right that there's this sense that even though we're technically connected, we don't really know what's going on in someone else's life beyond the filtered, curated perfection of Instagram tile. But it was super interesting writing about social media, because what I found was that for younger generations, so I've got three stepchildren, they're all teenagers, and the eldest two play video games. And during the pandemic, those video games were a lifeline, because they couldn't go out and socialize with their mates in a normal way, but they could befriend people who were also playing the same game. And for the younger generation, there's sometimes vanishingly little difference between a real life friend and a friend that they forged in this way. And I think that it also has real opportunities. I mean, when we were talking earlier about people who find it difficult to make friends, actually being able to belong to some kind of community through a screen is at least an opportunity of sorts. So I think it's a mixed bag with social media. I don't think it's a replacement wholesale for real life friendship, but I do think it can be a real complement to it if used appropriately.
You talk about a sort of a failed friendship with a girl called Becca, obviously not a real name, and you've anonymized it, I hope.
Yeah, thank you for making that point, because some people believe that I haven't. And I know, I honestly, I really highly anonymized a lot of it.
Because she doesn't come out of it very well, Elizabeth, at all.
Well, you
do have a problem, don't you? Because anybody who has been in your life at all is going to pick this book up and see if they're in it. I know there's no index at the back and you have anonymized it, but they may be able to identify themselves.
Yes. Well, anyone who I've mentioned by their real name, I sent them the passages that I wrote about them and they all okayed it. And then there are two incidents where I talk about...
Ella and Becca.
Exactly that, yeah. Ella and Becca, where the friendships are no longer an active part of my life and they did go awry. So Becca is someone who ghosted me seemingly overnight, as far as I was concerned. And Ella is someone who, during the pandemic, I think we both realized that we were in different places in our lives. And actually with Ella, I was able to let that one go with a great deal of love and fondness and affection, which I feel for her still. But we were in different places and... Yeah. Actually, that friendship, it was a friendship for a particular time in our lives. And I feel grateful for that. And with Becca, the process of writing about that ghosting, which was a really shocking thing to happen, and it caused me genuine grief.
Was it because the first time somebody had ghosted you? Was that it?
Yes. The first time I've been ghosted romantically.
Yeah, but you've been going through life thinking, I am the perfect friend. I can make friends and keep them.
Exactly. Which was delusional, right?
Yes,
of course, I wasn't the perfect friend, but it was something that was so key to my identity and how I thought of myself that when this happened to me, I thought, well, I must be a terrible failure of a person. And looking back on it and writing about it, I actually feel a lot of sympathy and empathy for Becca, because clearly she was going through something that she didn't feel able to tell me about.
Yeah.
And I should have been a better friend and been more open to asking about that rather than being scared to pose the question. And so I think it was a lack of, there was a lack of clarity in our friendship. But writing about it was very, very cathartic, because I now genuinely, I also feel kind of love towards her. And one of the things that I write about in the book is this idea that any friendship in our life still has shaped our internal landscape. It still shaped us as a person, even if they are no longer a daily presence, in the same way that a volcano can be dormant or it can be active, but it is still part of the landscape. And I found that a very helpful way to look at past friendships.
Well, it's a very provocative book. It's interesting what you say, you know, about, and you talk about friendship contracts, and you think that friendship doesn't get talked about enough and we need to talk about it more, ending them, maintaining them, all that sort of thing, because they are a huge part of our life, but we approach them quite casually, don't we, in every respect?
Yes, I think you're totally right. In contrast to dating, where we are very practiced with the idea that, you know, you might match with someone on an app, you might then text for a couple of weeks, then you might agree to go on a first date, and you might agree to go on a second, third date, you might start talking about your life goals, but you're very cautious, and rightly so. But with a friendship, there are two things at play. One is that friendship as a term is so broad and so diffuse that we've got no idea what different people mean by it. And actually, I didn't really have an idea what I meant by it until I wrote a whole book on it. And so it means that when we're approaching someone else that we might meet, like sitting next to at work, and we are being friendly, that can be mistaken for an overture to an actual friendship, which is a different thing. And that's the second thing, is sort of identifying the difference between being a friendly person and actively pursuing a friendship.
Well, Wilkie said that. He's 10, he knows.
Exactly. He knows. And as you said at the very beginning in your introduction, there's that study done by a professor called Jeffrey H. Hall about having to spend 200 hours on average to make a friend, to make a stranger into one of your best friends. Yeah. So it does take time, and we don't have infinite time in our lives. And we've just got to get much more practice at understanding who we want to devote our hours and our nourishment to.
You're talking to yourself really there. Friendaholic, Confessions of a Friendship Addict. Just before you go, you might say this to your dad, because Neil is producing today, right? And he was born in Altna Galvin Hospital in Derry. And they used to say up there, and maybe your dad knew this, that he was born in the US of A, because it was upstairs in Altnagelvin.
That's
USA.
Amazing.
There you go. So you can.
That is amazing. I will tell my dad.
You'll tell your dad that. Okay. So, friendaholic, Confessions of a Friendship Addict, Elizabeth Day. Congratulations on the book. And of course, there's the two podcasts as well, which is Best Friend Therapy with your best friend, Emma, and How to Fail as well. Both worth a listen. Lovely talking to you, Elizabeth.
You too, Ray. Thank you.
Bye now. Bye. Bye.
Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Patrick Bergen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Ray.
Yeah, it's not often that a guest says in the preamble to an interview, in my castle.
The oldest oak spiral staircase. We were discussing how the word clay.
Yeah.
Being left and left, and he wanted me to sit on his left so he could make it easy for him.
And you have the oldest oak spiral staircase in the country,
in the world,
in the world, in your castle,
in the castle.
Do you ever think of downsizing at all? No,
oh, it's a small castle,
it's a small castle, right? And because we were just discussing left handed and right handed, and stairs are designed with right handed people in mind, aren't they?
It can be, yeah.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And claymore, go on, explain that to me.
Oh, a claymore is a sword so big you have to use clay, your left.
Ah, as well as your right.
As
yes.
well as your right.
Ah, yeah, there you go.
So claymore is big left.
You're back on stage in the best exotic Marigold Hotel at Dublin's Borgosh Energy Theatre from May 16th to 20th.
That's it.
That's a fun thing to be involved in, isn't
it? It's a really good, feel-good, getting old movie.
Yeah.
I call it a movie because it was a movie originally.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And they put it on stage now, and it's just we've seen it on telly as well, and it's hilarious.
And you play the part of an aging Lothario.
That's it.
Yeah,
a dirty old man, in other words. Norman.
That's a good old laugh. That's a good.
Yeah. Any celery left in his stiff in his celery or whatever it is.
I don't know. So it must be great because lockdown was a bit tough for you, was it?
Well, yes and no. It was enjoyable to be able to watch and catch up on all sorts of things. And
yeah.
It was nice in its own, but it was tough on everybody, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So now we're all coming out and being happy and living life to the full. And as you get older, that's what you have to do. Live life, get your second chance, get your second breath or your third or your fourth, but get out there and do it.
But what's the alternative?
Exactly. Sad what alternative.
Is, okay, what is the alternative? What age are you? Do you mind me asking?
What age am I?
Yeah.
72.
Right.
You don't believe it, do you?
No, you look great. You look great.
You know, well, there's a saying, you know, that there are three ages of man. Youth, middle age, and you're looking well.
So, yeah, that's code for something else, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the fourth, of course, is just getting on with it.
Yeah, yeah. Are you still here? Oh, Lord. So, like, theatre, because we know you from the movies, we know you from EastEnders, and there are other movies in pre-production or post-production, are there?
There are indeed. I've got a couple, one called House at the End of the Lane, which is a thing I'm producing myself.
Right.
And the Athena Syndrome, which I'm doing with a director called Jason Figgis.
Yeah.
It stars Rita Tushingham, Leslie Ann Down and various people. I play kind of a James Bond character coming out of retirement. And and there's a film coming out. I should be working almost contemporaneously with what I'm doing now.
Right, okay.
So it's busy enough.
And you're in Blackbird.
And I was in Blackbird, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, with
Mike Flatley.
Great Michael Flatley, yeah.
Yeah. Are you friends?
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. He's a diamond geezer.
Yeah. I love his just dare and do. He just goes for it. People said, you can't make a movie, Michael, you're a dancer. And he did.
Well, he did, yeah. And it's not half bad.
Yeah.
It's really good, in fact. And it's entertaining. And he's good in it.
Yeah.
I'm okay in it. I don't have a lot to do, but I'm good in it.
Yeah.
And it's a good story, good narrative, and it's shot well. It's a very decent movie.
Who would you give the James Bond role to now? Any opinions on that? Any strong opinions?
Well, the Athena Syndrome that I'm doing, I'm playing an old
yes.
job.
Yes, yeah, that's what I asked.
Well, give it to me, of course.
Oh, yeah. I should have said present company excluded. Who would you give the James Bond role to?
I don't know. Who would you give it to?
Idris Elba, I think.
Okay.
I think Idris Elba, yeah. There's Jamie Dornan.
Could be.
Yeah. Anybody, any other suggestions there for James Bond? No.
Some move on.
What?
Move on.
Move on. Yeah. Move on to your... Look, I've heard you singing a lot, and Switzer's Window is that keeps coming up on my playlist every Christmas. It's a lovely song.
Yeah, it's a great song, yeah.
Yeah. And you have a new album out.
There's a new In the Air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where do you record?
Windmill Lane occasionally. Yeah. In various places around the world I've recorded. I've recorded in Nashville.
Right.
So, yeah.
And who do you hook up with?
Who would I was? Various musicians, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We had a bit of In the Air.
Ken Kiernan produced me.
And loads of different influences.
Oh, absolutely. Country, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What have you got? Have you got anything?
I've In the Air. Will I play a bit of that?
Play a bit
of that. Way up in the sky. Tell me, how do you fly? There's an African influence there, is there?
African Caribbean.
Yeah, African Caribbean.
Absolutely. And I recorded that one actually in Trinidad.
Did you?
Yeah.
I love that rhythm.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely stuff.
And then there's more sort of ballady stuff.
Glorious years when we ride with our heads in.
Time is the name of that one.
Time, yeah.
Yeah.
Time passes and we all get older, don't we?
We do. So the music, hugely important to you. You keep coming back to it.
Very much so. I mean, it was my first love in that sense. And I love writing songs. I love singing. And I'm just listening to your interview with John Richard.
Yeah,
it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Lovely music and great guy.
Yeah. Okay, like right back to...
Hopefully I'll go and see the show tonight.
Right back to Minogue's in London, when you went over to London first.
I used to play in Minogue's and all the various pubs in London, yeah.
And what instrument is your instrument of choice?
I was playing guitar and harmonica. Very influenced by Bob Dylan.
Right.
And Donovan and people like that.
Yeah,
so I used to play the guitar and harmonica.
Yeah.
Strum away.
We were talking about friendship there.
Yeah.
Where does that, what part does that play in your life?
It's very, very important. I mean, I've got some very old friends. I've got friends that I've known since I was 6 and 7. I still have
them. Do you?
Yeah.
From Drimna.
Yeah. Right. Robbie Butner, Peter Smith, various people like that who were very close to me. And quite a few people from London, still good friends with me.
Because you've been through an awful lot, haven't you, over the years? Like you were, you know, I remember I was going to get it out there. I have a picture of you and me in Las Vegas.
Really?
He's getting scared
now. Were we alone?
We were fully clothed, anyway. No, you had been Dracula, and it was a video retailers conference, and I interviewed you there, so it was all
fantastic. Yeah, I played Frankenstein, I've played Dracula, I've played Casanova, I played you know, it's quite a few different characters. It's wonderful.
Do you ever look at yourself? Is there any movie you return to? Do you know if you're having a bad day?
Well, the one that would get me every time would be Mountains of the Moon.
Right,
and
is that one of your first ones?
It was pretty early on. It was about 89, 90.
Right. Okay.
And, of course, Sleeping with the Enemy, I think, is a great movie.
Yeah.
And but my favourite is, I was in the very, very last Twilight Zone ever filmed that was written by Rod Serling.
Right.
Where the Dead Are. Yeah, I advise you to, you can get it.
Yes, yeah.
And that's my go-to movie
is
for
it?
Myself.
For yourself?
I love the Twilight Zone.
You know, what mood would you have to be in?
Jack Palance was in that.
What mood would you have to be in to watch that now? Do you know what I mean? Is it a pick-me-up or is it a sort of a...
black and white move.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? The 1950s sort of thriller type.
That's the one. Because you were saying that about Blackbird, you were saying Mike Flatley was great and I was only okay. So we all have that voice, don't we?
I wasn't in it enough.
It wasn't that I was bad, it was just that I wasn't in it enough. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Love Patrick Bergen. Worked with his brother Emmett many years ago. Look forward to Marigold Hotel. Love the movie Siobhan and Rathfarnham. Do you know, it's this year is 40 years since the first airing of Glen Rowe. Did you know that?
I did not. No, Emmett was in that.
Emma was in that. I've had the pleasure of playing bass with the legend Patrick Bergen many Monday nights in Brookcells. Such a talent. Great vibe master. So cool. Yeah. Does it get a bit scarier going on stage as you get older?
Yeah, I mean, the last time I was on stage, I suppose I did. I found and produced a play called "But the Last of the Spell of the Blarney Stone" down in Cork Opera House, and before that, I did another one down in the Cork Opera. It's called "Murder at Shanty Hall." But I was just chatting to Josh Ritter outside because they're doing doing a show at Liberty Hall.
Liberty Hall tonight, yeah.
And I did a show there some years ago called "A Trinity of Two," with written by Ulaagh O'Connor. And Adrian Dunbar played Oscar Wilde, right. and I played Edward Carson.
Right.
It was the show in which it was about the trial of Oscar Wilde. But what happened was that at the end of it was the opening night of the Importance of Being Earnest, and.
So Oscar Wilde.
Oscar Wilde was
Carson.
Carson, of course. But what happened was that Lord Queensberry, who's the Queensberry rules, the boxer, his son was having a fling with Oscar.
Right.
So he was very upset with Oscar. And he went to Oscar and presented him with a head of cabbage.
Right.
At the end of the show, and Oscar took it and smelled it and went, "Every time I smell it, I'll think of you." In his disgust, Carson went round and. Said to Oscar Wilde, living in sodomy, which was of course a crime,
and yes.
Oscar and his hubris took a offence and sued for defamation of character, and I played. So Edward Carson defended
Oscar
Queensberry
against Oscar Wilde,
not the other way around.
Yes.
And won the case, and then when Oscar lost that, he the Crown decided to prosecute him.
Right.
But it's all to do with getting old and having second chances.
I just need to say thanks to Patrick Bergen. I brought my dad to his harmonica festival in Galway. We are from Pimlico. Pat and my dad, John, got photos and he showed my dad such great respect. Invited us back to the after party. My dad felt like a star. My dad passed away last year, aged 89. Thank you, Patrick. That's the son, Paul. So there you go.
Oh, lovely. It's very important to have affection for your father.
Yeah, but you don't know how you affect people's lives. Like, that's a lovely memory for that man, isn't it?
I'm glad he brought up the subject because I'd like to thank somebody being buried today, Laura Quinlan. And she had a fall and in her mid-30s, had six children, and she's being buried today.
Oh, right. And how did you know her?
Her partner, Gavin, did some work for me around the castle.
Oh, that's very.
But it's
sad.
So important to acknowledge your parents as well and
yes.
your family.
Yeah.
And my father handed on some lovely stuff for me, and I always he's like a Shanachie as well. As you get older, you learn from your elders.
Yeah.
He gave me a very good trick actually. He said because very often you're asked if you speak Irish, for example, and he said to me once. He says if you're ever asked that, he says this is what you say: "Is Gael Misha." Augustus Misha Aum Gael, Ni Higam Gornara Dome, Nil Cossig Mugrim Erein Far Satel, Och Ni Lane Far Cachienta, Ni Is Far No May. Which translates as "Is Gael Misha, I'm Irish.
Yes.
Is Misha Aum Gael, I'm descended from Irish. Ni Higam Gornara Dome.
I don't understand what.
I know no shame in that.
Right.
Nil Cossig Mugrim Erein Far Satel, I wouldn't turn Mugrim my back. On any man in the world. Och ni lane far kachienta. Ordinary. There is no ordinary man. Ni is far na me.
You have such an amazing voice.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing voice. I listen to you all day. Will you stay? Do you want to hear Josh Ritter sing live?
Absolutely.
Yes, so we're going to bring Josh back in. We're going to have a quick commercial break. Patrick's going to stay with us. And we'll
shame it didn't bring me harmonica.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Tweet at Radio Ray RTE. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, what's that Irish you won't turn your back on?
You're Cossig McGrim. It ain't far so tale.
Well, you did to Josh Ritter, but you're turned around now and you can look at Josh Ritter. Josh, Liberty Hall tonight, sold out. And the new album is called?
Spectral Lines.
But you're going to do a cover for us now.
Yeah, yeah. Sing.
Patrick might do a duet. You never know what's going to happen here.
I hope you do.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll make Eunice.
Outside another yellow moon has punched a hole in the nighttime, yeah. I climb to the window and down to the street. I'm shining like a new dime. Downtown trains are full, full of those Brooklyn girls. They try so hard to break out of their little world. You wave your hands and they scatter like crows. They have nothing that could ever capture your heart. They're just thorns without the rose. Be careful of them in the dark. Well, if I was the one you choose to be, your one and only one. Oh, can't you hear me now? Can't you hear me now? Well, I'll see you tonight on a downtown train. All of my dreams, they fall like rain. All on a downtown train. I know your window and I know it's late. I know your stairs and your doorways. I walk down the street past your gate. I stand by the light of the four-way and watch them fall. Oh baby, they all have heart attacks. They'll stay at the carnival, but they'll never win you back, no. Well, I see you tonight on a downtown train. All of my dreams, they fall like rain. All on a downtown train. Will I see you tonight on a downtown train? All of my dreams, they fall like rain. All on a downtown train. All on a downtown train. All on a downtown train.
Yeah.
Tom Waits there.
Great version of a great song.
Love that guy.
He was hinting at an invite to the gig, Patrick was.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you're going to invite him?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I cannot wait.
You're invited along. You're invited along.
Thank you. I'm honored.
Yeah, there you go.
So honored.
We're going to see Josh Ritter tonight, and we're so excited. Dee, Nevin and Darren come from Galway. Somebody else says, Dora says, I'm really looking forward to seeing Josh later. Josh was kind enough to reply to a letter our children sent to him during lockdown. They were absolutely thrilled. And Josh Ritter played a most exquisite blinder of a gig in Wexford back in 2001. He wowed everyone in the room. He could not complete day two or three of the festival as he got a call to be part of the Bob Dylan lineup in Kilkenny that same weekend. Is that, you remember that?
Oh, yeah. I remember going down and seeing Glenn play that. That was really fun, man.
Yeah.
Wow.
And great to hear Patrick Bergen, says Anna. And you can see Patrick Bergen in the best exotic Marigold Hotel, Dublin's Bord Gáis Energy Theatre, May 16th to 20th, bordgáistheatre.ie. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Josh Ritter, Patrick Bergen.
Thank you.
Josh Hinnan on the pre-skeleton and Oak Taylor. Cáit to Wallace. Gurumaga Cáit, thank you very much. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Jenny says, I'll never forget bumping into Patrick Bergen one night years ago in a restaurant. I was a waitress and it wasn't long after I watched Sleeping with the Enemy. I had no idea who he was. I bumped into him and nearly had a heart attack with the fright. Love the movie. Still gives me the shivers. Yeah. On friendship, the writer Maya Angelou said to Oprah Winfrey, if you want a friend, you have to be a friend. Yes, well, it is a reciprocal relationship, friendship. Now, the whodunit quiz. Press the button there. Thank you. No, I'll try it again because the fader wasn't up. Press the button. Thank you. Yeah, hey, that's more like it. Two quizzers standing by. And there is a prize as well. It's a two-night stay in the Killarney Towers Hotel and Leisure Centre in Killarney. And a meal on one of the evenings in the Inishfallen restaurant. And it's a perfect location to explore the Wild Atlantic Way down Kerry Way or just explore Killarney. KillarneyTowers.com. KillarneyTowers.com. Hello, Susan. How are you?
Hello, Ray. Fine, thank you.
Susan O'Loughlin in Donegal. Whereabouts exactly in Donegal are you?
At the moment, I'm right in the middle of Donegal town.
Right. And that's not home by the sounds of it.
No, I live in Mount Charles. It's 10-minute drive away.
I know where Mount Charles is. That's a beautiful part of the country. It's out on a peninsula, is it, Mount Charles?
It is, it is. And it's surrounded by water. It's lovely on the wide Atlantic Way.
Yes, and there's a lighthouse at the end of it.
No, we don't have a like that.
I'm thinking of somewhere else then. Where am I thinking? Very close to Mount Charles.
Oh, St. John's Point, halfway between Mount Charles and Killybeg.
Ah, that's where I'm thinking of, yes.
Yes.
Which is a peninsula as well.
Yes.
So what do you're at work then, what do you do?
I'm a dental hygienist.
Right.
In the Blue Poppy Dental Surgery in Donegal Town.
Not a job for the faint-hearted.
No, I love my job though, I'm very lucky. I've been working with a great team.
Yes.
And lovely patients, so yeah.
How long are you doing it for?
Oh, God, 30 years.
30? Wow.
Yes, long time.
Yeah. And I see husband is Gregory and one of your sons is, your son is in Australia.
He is.
And is he there for good?
No. He is been there now nearly 2 years. So he's travelling in Australia and he's coming home to work in July.
Wow, that's a relief, I'd say, is it?
Yeah, well, looking forward to seeing him. I'm glad he's had a good time, but looking forward to having him home to work in Ireland. So that will be great.
And you have a daughter as well. What's she up to?
A daughter, Kerry. She's listening. She's studying for her exams in Trinity.
What's she studying?
So, she's going to in neuroscience.
Neuroscience. Wow. Oh, wow. So that's a tough time now, heading into the finals, isn't it, for her?
It is, but she's nearly there and looking forward to a summer in Boston doing a J1. So
she's
nearly there.
Great. You're up against Paul Dunn in Drimna. How are you doing, Paul?
Hello, Ray. How are you?
Patrick Bergen's hometown.
Yeah.
Did you know that? You did. You didn't. I don't know. What are you up to today, Paul?
Just finishing work shortly and then off to the daughter has gymnastics later on, so down for that.
Brilliant. What age is she?
She's 5.
It says here she can do aerials. Is that that's they, the that,
she tries to do an aerial on the grass on the way into school in the morning.
Right. Okay. Because my memory of an aerial is that it's a cartoon with no hands. Is that it?
Correct.
Right. How does she get on?
The older cousins can do it.
Right.
She tries to copy them. She's not there yet.
Right.
She has to master it yet.
Well, like she's aspiring to it. She's only 5, fair play to her. What's the plan for the weekend?
My godmother's getting married. Eric and Eileen are getting married out in Lucan, so we're attending that wedding on Saturday.
Right, okay. And you had a bit of a crisis there with the trousers.
Chelsea took the trousers out and said they think you need to look at them, so we checked them, so they're gone to the dry cleaners this morning and they'll be ready tomorrow. So
right, and they're for the suit, because that you don't wear a suit from one end of the year to the other and then you take it down and something's left over from the last time you wore it or whatever. So lucky you spotted it. Yeah, lucky you spotted it. and it's Eric and who?
Eric and Eileen.
Well, we wish them well and I hope the weather stays fine for them this Saturday out in Lucan.
Hopefully.
Right, Paul versus Susan. 3 questions each. The rules, I give you the category, then I ask if you want a clue or not. If you go for a clue, you get a point for a correct answer. If you go clueless, without a clue, you get 2 points. And whoever has the most points at the end is the winner. And if it's a tie on points, we go to a tiebreak question. Good luck to you both. Here we go. Okay, Susan, music is the first category for you. Do you want a clue or not?
Yes, please.
Okay. Right, here it is. Listen carefully. One of the members of this group was once a radio show host. Who is this for 1 point? Am I supposed to leave you now? When you're looking like that, I can't believe what I just gave away now. I can't take it back. I don't want to get lost. I don't want to live my life without you. Who's that?
Oh. Niall Horan. No, sorry.
No. Westlife. You see, the hint there was Nicky. Nicky Byrne was a radio show host. Okay, early days, so there's no panic. Paul, music for you as well. Do you want a clue or not?
We'll try no clue.
No clue for two. Here we go. Who is this?
It's just us.
Who's that for 2 points?
Harry Styles.
It is Harry Styles, as it was. Yeah, 2 points. Good start for you. Back to you, Susan. The next category, sports stars.
Okay.
Now, Paul is on the board with 2 points. Do you want to go for a clue or not?
No.
No, okay. So for 2 points, who is this sports star?
This time around, I'm a lot more experienced and... I suppose I know exactly what I need to do and what I have to do, and you know, so I've been doing it. I suppose there's so much, I don't know, it just means so much, I suppose, you know, the result of the Olympic Games.
Who's that?
Oh, I, of course I can picture,
yes.
But I can't.
Go on!
Oh, I do, of
Go
course
on.
I
no,
know.
No, 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 no,
sorry.
No!
Oh,
Sonia,
I'll be killed.
Sonia Sullivan.
Of course.
Nobody will kill you. No, you won't be killed. No, you won't be killed. You probably won't win, but you won't be killed. Right, okay, right. So, yeah, Paul, if you get anything from this, Susan can't catch you. Because she can only get 2 points. You're on two already. So if you get even 1 point from this, you're today's winner. So what do you want to do?
We'll take the clue. Please.
Yes, you might as well. Yes, yeah. So this Irish football legend's goal against Italy made history at the World Cup in 1994 for 1 point and to win the quiz today. Who is this?
So we went into a lot of confidence and a lot of belief that came from the manager, Jack Charlton, as well. He had a game plan and we executed it as best we could. We got that early goal, which was usually important. And then, in truth, the second half, we did hang on a bit. England had a few opportunities in the game, but it turned out to be a very famous victory because it was the first time Ireland qualified for a major tournament.
Who's that?
It's Ray Houghton.
It is! He put the ball in Italy's net and the English net back in 1988 as well. And you get a point for that. You probably would have got it without a clue. Yeah, you're today's winner, Paul. Susan, sorry about that.
No, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. As they say, they didn't suit you. We're going to send you out a Ray Darcy Show Keep Cup. Lovely talking to you. Mind yourself, Susan.
Thank you very
bye
much.
Now.
Bye
now. Bye,
well
bye,
done,
bye,
Paul.
Bye, bye. That's Susan up there in Donegal.
Thank you.
Paul, well done. You are off to Killarney with a person of your choice. Loads of things to do down there. And you can see what's in store for you at killarneytowers.com. Enjoy the wedding and everything else. Well done, Paul.
Thanks very much, Ray.
See ya.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Good afternoon, Brian O'Driscoll.
Good afternoon, Ray. How are you?
Good. Good to talk to you.
Long time no chat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it was your book. How long ago was that? Maybe it wasn't.
Yeah, oh my God, that's like 9 or 10 years ago.
You must be due a second one.
Just a decade.
Yeah, just a decade, yeah. Anyway, you're here to get us enthused for Saturday's game in the Women's Six Nations. It's Ireland v England in Musgrave Park. And we want a full house there.
Yeah, that's the goal. And obviously, I think the important thing for people to know is, you know, we don't want to be a country of the upside support or the sunny day supporter. I think when teams need you most, when they're maybe struggling or they're in a developmental phase, and that's definitely the case with this new breed of professional women that have come on the scene. So I think, albeit the results haven't quite gone the way they would have wanted, it doesn't mean that they don't need your support. And what that can do, looking up to a full, you know, stadium, a full stand, can give you the motivation and bring the energy to your game that only players really fully appreciate. And so I suppose what we're trying to do as part of the Guinness Never Settle campaign is to fill out Musgrave Park. It's 8,000 odd people, so I'm sure we can achieve that this weekend against England, against a great England team as well.
But yeah, they're unbeaten. Unbeaten. I'm looking at their record in the Six Nations so far. Wales 59-3, Scotland 58-7, Italy 68-5, They've clocked up 185 points in three games, Brian. Like the, it's a big ask, isn't it?
It is a huge ask. I was lucky to be down at the Rugby World Cup final in New Zealand at the end of last year and watched them taking on New Zealand. They were hotly tipped over there. They'd gone on a 17 or 18 game unbeaten run, and they were beaten in the last moments of the game. So it feels as though, you know, they're not a team in transition. Yeah, there's one or two players that have retired, but these, they are a fully loaded side. There's been a few changes to them, but they will be bringing a phenomenal standard of rugby. So our girls are going to have to really up their own game and just work on previous performances. And the expectation to win the game might be a bit much, but I think, you know, you learn so much against better teams. I think that's the place that this current Irish side is at.
From your career, can you remember a particular match where the crowd were the winning of the game, that you drew from them?
I think there's lots of games. I think sometimes it's about silencing crowds when you're away from home. I remember, you know, the first time we won in Paris in 2000, you know, a huge amount of going to France was about keeping that crowd quiet and not giving them something to roar about, letting their team getting away with it. And then from a home perspective, I remember, albeit we lost the game in the last seconds against New Zealand in 2014, but I've never experienced an energy in that crowd quite like that for the first 79 minutes. It was explosive, and when you can feel that the hairs on the back of your neck stand up when you make a big carry or make a big collision or do something impactful, when you give the crowd something to cheer about, that puts pep in your step. It, you know, the chest swell and you feel as though you play beyond yourself. So I think that's such an important component to sport, to live sport, and making sure that you hear yourself heard, that everyone on the pitch hears you shouting and roaring from the rooftops and giving the encouragement that they need.
Do you miss that?
Oh, yeah, of course you'll. I think I'm going to miss it, Ray, when I'm grey and old. Now, I'm getting grey, and I'm starting to get old. But I think I was in denial for the first few years. I really was. For the first three or four, I'd always come up with an excuse as to, you know, why I didn't miss it anymore. I don't miss preseason, or don't miss, you know, struggling to get out of bed in the morning. But in truth, that's what I really miss.
Right.
Because it's a job well done. There's a satisfaction that comes with that. So I genuinely feel that I'll look on enviously in another 15 or 20 years' time at the next generation coming through and think, that those were the days, or back in my day, you know, I'll be one of those guys giving it that line too, yeah.
My son asked me the other day, Dad, what age do you have to be when you can say back in my day?
I'm well and truly into that. I think it's when your kids get to a conversation age, basically.
That's
where they can call you out on it. That's the time. You're not aware you're saying it yourself until someone calls you up on it.
So here you were tweeting there on Tuesday about your dad, Frank. This is big news and great news. Go on, tell us.
I can't tell you how big this is in our house, Ray. My dad got capped for Ireland in 1970, or played in two test matches against Argentina. And back in those days, there were certain international games that weren't seen as test caps for some reason. I don't know why. Anyway, it was a real bone of contention. Obviously, I managed to go and get capped quite a few times, and yet he had never received an actual physical test cap, or never been acknowledged to have played in a test match. So it's finally come good where the IRFU have, I don't know whether the committee that was put together to dig a bit deeper. There's only 12 individuals that are alive, I believe, that have not been awarded their test caps. So they're going to be awarded them in the pre-World Cup games. I think Ireland-England game in the Aviva Stadium in August. So there is a lot of excitement in our house.
So he'll be out.
Yeah, no, it's really cool.
Yeah,
it's really
cool. Yeah, no, that's brilliant. He'll be out on the pitch then, will he? He'll be out on the pitch.
Oh, yeah. He's going to be out there. He's going to milk the absolute James in. Oh, no, he's going to do the dog of it for sure. But I presume, you know, he talked about wanting to have a photo of the two of us with our caps, which would nearly bring a tear to your eye.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
that will be a really cool thing to do. So yeah, I'm looking forward to being the one in the stand and cheering him on.
That's 53 years in the getting.
Not a long time to wait.
Wow. But yeah, worth the wait. You mentioned...
I think he had kind of felt it had bypassed him. And so for it to come this late on is really brilliant. Thrilling.
Yeah. So it's a World Cup year. You mentioned it there. And Ireland are looking great. Are you nervous about the hype around it?
Yeah, of course. But like, I'm firmly on the bandwagon as well, thinking right. that how are we not going to win the World Cup? No, the thing about the World Cup is, the pre-season beforehand, it's a real equalizer. Whereas, irrespective of where you are in the pecking order, coming into that, it's the first and only chance of a four-year cycle for teams to have a pre-season together. And the amount of work that they can put in a 6 or 7 week period is significant. And I feel all the other teams that are on playing catch up managed to do that. So teams like Australia and New Zealand, who are very quiet at the moment, England will be back very competitive again. All these sides will have an opportunity to kind of put proper continuity together. International rugby is very tricky to train for. You get sporadic weeks here and there before a Six Nations or before a summer tour or before November internationals, but not that concerted period of time together that allows you to gel and work on combinations. So that's why I think everyone will be playing catch up. And historically, we've never really been able to do it at rugby.
We got it wrong 1 year, didn't we? Badly wrong.
Oh, we got it terribly wrong in 07. Yeah.
What happened there?
We were really good in the Six Nations. We should have actually won the Six Nations. We probably should have won the Grand Slam. We lost to France in injury time, a bit like that New Zealand game. And then we had huge confidence going into the preseason, but the game was very physical at the time, and we had Argentina and France in our group, and the focus was so much on weightlifting and getting huge and being able to deal with them physically that we forgot about our ball skills. We didn't actually touch a rugby ball for the first 6 weeks, or 5 weeks of preseason. And by the time we actually got to the games, we had no skills. And then all of a sudden our confidence was shot. So yeah, the preparation for that one was a disaster.
And was there
considering
something
where the pitch of that team was?
And was there something about ice baths or something, or cryogenic something or other?
Oh well, yeah, we used to go out to Poland the whole time. Yeah, we used to go out for preseason. And if you go to an Olympic training facility, now this is an Olympic training facility from the 60s,
right.
It's pretty barren and sparse. But yet the whole idea was that there was literally nothing else to focus on. We used to go into cryotherapy sessions where, yeah, you go in minus 120, and whatnot, and go in for like 90 seconds, and apparently it aided your recovery process,
right.
And I don't know. I think it was a bit of a placebo, to be honest with
you.
There was no talking your way out of it, irrespective. And so we did that for a number of years, but that seems to have fallen by the wayside a bit.
Right. It is a golden age of Irish rugby, and I suppose Leinster are leading the charge. I was just looking at them there against the Lions last week. They were down to 13 men at one stage. And they came back and won 39-36. And for people who are casual fans of rugby, they probably wouldn't recognise any of those Leinster players. And yet they're winning at that level, which is
that was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
It really was. Like, to think of the strength of depth.
Yes.
And like, they've used the best part of 60 players this year. You know, so when you're reaching into academy players, sub-academy players, guys being pulled from the club game to play get their first provincial cap. So the standard and the quality of players being able to seamlessly come in and transition into the team, and for the team not to skip a beat is what is a real point of difference with this Leinster side. Yes, they do have a host of internationals and quality players, but it's actually the peripheral players that are showing the massive strength and depth of the team. And I think that augurs well for the future of the game, obviously in this province, but also plugging into the national team over the next World Cup cycle as well. As much as our focus is on France later on, also there's great excitement about the next 4 years because of how well the under-20s have done in the last 2 years, winning the Grand Slam. There's a new breed coming through next year. They're very, very hotly tipped as well. So it augurs well for the future of the game. But all eyes will be on France later on in the year.
And what about the future of the game, Brian? Because, we know that there are a number of class actions coming down the track in the UK and in Ireland about concussion. And despite the changing of the rules over and over again, it doesn't look like they've sorted that out.
Not properly yet, no. Ray, not properly. And it's a work in progress for sure. And I'm part of different kind of committees and boards of trying to help alleviate the concerns of, you know, of parents and future, you know, the future generations that are hopefully going to play this great game. It is always going to be in some shape or form a dangerous sport. There still will be concussions. But I think the important thing is trying to look at ways and means of changing the laws to reduce those concussions, to look after our players a little bit better. You know, things like the, you know, on failed HIAs after a game, immediately sitting players down for 12 days. That sort of thing is relatively new to the game. Yeah. I think that will future-proof the game somewhat. But, you know, you will never be able to get rid of high shots where people are tired, you know, flailing arms, awkward moments. That's just part of a collision sport. But it's about how can we reduce them significantly where we make it safer. Mm. It's never going to be fully safe, but safer is the goal.
And you mentioned their parents, and that's that, because that's the big thing, isn't it? Because they will decide ultimately if they have, and you have two sons, so you will have to decide at some stage whether you want them to play rugby or not.
My little fella forced my hand during COVID. Rugby was one of the only things that was up and running, and he wasn't playing it at the time.
Right.
And he said, "Dad, can I play rugby?" And I was like, I really wanted to hold off until he was kind of 12 or 13. Anyway, we got into it, and he liked it, not as much as soccer, but he broke his collarbone in October. And I thought, oh my God, at 7 years of age, I don't know if I need that in my life. But it didn't stop him at all.
I shouldn't be laughing.
No. It's one of those. I was like, oh, Jade, I don't think he realised he's an awful lot smaller than everybody else. He obviously sees a different person in the mirror every day than the one that we're looking at. But he goes around relatively fearlessly and firing into people. So, but it hasn't lessened his interest in it at all. And I think in the balance of concussion, the really important thing is always to look at the upside as much as the downside of the game. All of the relationships, all of the values, all the camaraderie, all the great things that I managed to get out of the game have to be balanced up against the dangers of the sport, of which there are some too. So, I think just let them furrow their own path, whatever he wants. He still thinks he's going to play for Liverpool, but I'm not entirely sure of that. I hope he's not listening.
He has two generations of rugby caps now to deal
he
with.
He certainly that, does.
So how are you? Because when looking back, I remember being at your testimonial dinner, and you thanked all the various doctors who helped you. And it was like elbows, knees, and toes, whatever. You went on like, thank doctor this for my knee, and this guy for my hip, and this guy for my shoulder. So how are you feeling physically yourself?
Pretty good. I get a bit of residual back trouble, but Pilates kind of keeps that at bay. I'm in the process of getting myself a reformer for the house.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
I've had to commit to that. I've had to, because like it's difficult with busy schedules to always fit in classes, and sometimes they're booked out and whatnot.
Yeah.
But I'm now going to get one where if I can get my core working and I can get all my flexibility going, I travel so much better.
Right.
And I feel a million times better. So that is the one thing. That I bring Pilates balls everywhere I go with me, in every seat that I sit in. I've got about 10 of them around the house. My car, Amy's car.
And that's for the back.
So it's the one
that's
thing that puts me in a better postural position.
Okay.
That's the only residuals that I have. Yeah.
I better get this in before you go, Brian. So Musgrave Park, 2:15 on Saturday. The Ireland's women team versus England. And they need your support. We want a full house, 8,008 people, full seats. Great. Brian, great talking to you. Don't be a stranger.
Always fun, right?
Good luck. See you.
Thanks,
bye, bye, bye.
Good man. Bye, bye, bye.
Bye, bye. That's it from us. Sarah and Cormac are on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3:00. And we're live from Laytown. Yes, we're going sea swimming and all sorts of things. So join us tomorrow live from Laytown at 3:00. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday evening.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.